We all want to be in control of something, don't we? I mean, our kids, our schedule, our eating habits, our relationships, we want life on our terms. But there's a time and place where demanding to be in control brings pain, frustration, and even dissatisfaction. Today, I want to share with you how to avoid going to that destructive place. Stay with me.
Welcome to this Monday edition of Living on the Edge with Chip Ingram. Living on the Edge features the Bible teaching of Chip Ingram on this daily discipleship program. I'm Dave Drewy, and today Chip continues our current series, God's Boundaries for Abundant Living, a fresh look at the Ten Commandments. Chip's got a great recommendation after the teaching for how to really get this message into practice, so be sure to stay with us for that. But now, let's get going and join Chip for his message, No Worship But True Worship, from Exodus chapter 20.
I want to start with I'm sure, apocryphal story that has no theological bearing, and I'm sure someone made it up, but it makes a tremendous point. There's a little boy who wanted a bike, and he was a ornery, almost downright mean little boy. And he said, Mom, I want a bike. Mom, I want a bike. Mom, I want a bike. And he tried and tried and tried. She said, you are a mean, ornery little boy, and I'm not going to give you a bike. You need to learn some major lessons in life. And so he just kept asking, and he wanted a bike. And so finally, she said, well, why don't you talk to Jesus? And maybe Jesus will give you a bike. And so he decided he would sit down and have a little talk with Jesus, and was not a child that would really actually go to church much, and he was ornery and mean. And so he sat down and he thought he wasn't good at praying, he would write it out. And so he started his letter, Dear Jesus, I've been perfect. Will you please give me a bike? He was also a liar, so he crumpled that up and threw it away. And then he wrote another note and he said, Dear Jesus, I've really not been perfect, but I've been very good. Would you please give me a bike? And he crumpled that up, threw it around. Then finally he said, Dear Jesus, I want to be good, but I'm not. And then he kind of tilted his head. No, that's not really true either. He crumpled it up, threw it. And he remembered a friend and came from a little bit different background. And he went to his friend's house and he found a statue of Mary. He took the statue of Mary when they weren't looking, wrapped her in a towel, put duct tape around the towel, stuck Mary, the towel, and the duct tape under his bed, and then wrote the last note. Dear Jesus, if you ever want to see your mother again, you better give me a bike. Now, somebody made that up, but it definitely tells a story. It's self-indicting because it reflects one of the most common attempts of all people of all time. It's our desire to get God in small, manageable terms that we can control, to get him to do for us on our terms what we want done. And often the way to do that is with some sort of object that can take God from the invisible, eternal, awesome, all-powerful creator to a something we can see, control, tame, and manage. And the second command is going to talk about God's prohibition, his boundary against that. You'll notice by way of review, the focus of the first command is the object of our worship. You might just write the word object down. It's about the who. No gods but God. God demands exclusive worship of Yahweh. That's his point. The focus of the second command is not the object, but the manner or the method of our worship. This is the how. He's going to say that even if you worship the right God, you can worship the right God in the wrong way. And I said to bring a pen because we need to do a little Bible study. Have you got it? Pull it out. And we're going to read the next passage out of Exodus 20, but the structure is very simple. There are two commands and two reasons. Follow along, and if I see your pen, you can underline a couple key words. First, the command, you shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above, or on earth beneath, or on the water underneath the earth. Verse 5, you shall not worship them or serve them. Underline, if you will, shall not make for yourself an idol. That's the first command. It says, don't make any idol. By the way, the word for idol here, there's 14 different Hebrew words for idol. This particular word means a statue, a figurine, a wooden or a molten object. Then the next word, not only is it an idol, but he expands it to any likeness, any visual or pictorial representation. He says, don't make pictures in your worship and try to reduce God down to a snapshot. And so the first command is, don't make an idol, don't make a likeness of anything you see. Now you remember, they're living in a world where the sun, the moon, the stars, and every animal under the sun has been worshiped. God says, command number one, don't do it. Notice command number two, you shall not worship them or serve them. Not only are you not to make an idol or a likeness, but you shall not worship them. Literally, the word means to bow down, to physically bow down, to worship or serve these idols or likenesses that you could make. This is radical. I mean, some of you are thinking, as one guy told me, you know what? This morning was one of the most convicting messages I've heard in a long time. And I bet some of you at this point are thinking, you know, well, I'm glad I came tonight because, you know, I checked the garage before I came and, you know, got on my cell phone. And as far as I know, no statues laying around the house. Not idol worship has been something, you know, I've been a 12-step program. I've overcome idol worship. No problem with that. Well, you know what? It's going to be interesting to see some of the modern day applications. But the first command, don't make them. The second command is don't bow down or serve them. Then notice the two reasons. He says, for I, the Lord, his covenant name Yahweh, your God, am a jealous God. Underline that, will you? That's the first reason. I'm a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children on the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Interesting. All throughout the Old Testament, when God's people would turn away from him and worship an idol or worship another god, he would call it spiritual adultery. And he says that when we turn away from the true God, or when you develop a pattern where God, out of his zealous, loyal, caring love, he says that when we worship an idol, we actually are demonstrating that we hate him. Notice the second reason, but he goes on to say, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. So reason number one, he says, don't make them and don't serve them, is I'm a jealous God. And reason number two is because there are some good things that will happen to your children, and there's some bad things that will happen to your children based on whether you bow down and worship idols or not. Now, at this point in time, we read this out of our 21st century ears, and it's like, I mean, what are we going to do with this one? I mean, does anyone really struggle with idol worship? I mean, I was trying to make a little fun with that 12-step program, and I could tell a few heads are going, what's he talking about, a 12-step program for idols? I was kidding, okay? I was just kidding, joking, you know. And what I wanted to make the point was is that, you know, I didn't read this passage and say, Lord, speak to my heart. Where am I struggling with, you know, creating little wooden objects and putting them on the mantle and lighting candles? But you do understand that all around the world, millions and millions and hundreds of millions of people are bowing down to statues. That in not just jungles, but in whole nations, their worship revolves around making statues and images and likenesses that they bow down to and pray to and touch and kiss, and not just in other world religions, but among Christendom. And this is being violated every single day. And what I want to share with you is why this is so important. And what I want to get by the end of our time is God's heart on this. Remember, it's about boundaries. God is saying this because he has so much better for us. Now, understanding the second command, as you'll turn the page, you need a little historical background. This is written to a group of people that have spent the last 400 years looking at every turn to about 1,500 different gods that all have a little statue that represent them. This is written to a people that are now in the land of the Canaanites, where they had multiple graven images and statues. And I mean, they were vile. I mean, one of the gods of the Baal gods and the Chemosh gods is they would take their children, and Israel later would participate, and they would take their newborn children, and it was a big statue, and they would build a big fire. And to appease the god, they would take their little baby infants, and they would throw it up into the fire, and they would be consumed alive. And this would be worship to a false god. God understands the vile pagan worship, and he's telling them from day one, I will not tolerate any of it. In other words, there's only 10 commands, and number one is have no other gods besides me. And number two, I mean, this must be pretty high on the priority list. Number two is don't make any idols, Don't make anything that looks like any of the creation of the creatures, and don't bow down to them. And so out of the context, you need to understand this is radical. This is like someone saying to you, what I want you to do is I want you to drive to the store, but you can't drive a car. In other words, what do you say? Wait a minute. The only way you can drive is a car or a truck. No, there's a whole new different way of transportation. He's speaking to a group of people that all they have ever known is idol worship of some form. And he's going to spend the next 11 months at the foot of this great mountain, Mount Sinai, and teach them how to now worship in spirit and in truth. How to worship not a false God with images, and which almost always led to gross immorality, but a God who is invisible, a God who is eternal, a God who is holy, a God who is pure. And the second aspect of how to do this is going to be no idols, no graven images, and don't bow down to them. As you turn the page now, what I want to do is dig in a little bit on this, and let's look at this, what I call the command restated. And what I mean by that is I want to do a little analysis. If I wanted to put verses 4 and the first half of 5 in my own words, the command would be, no man-made idols are to be used as a means of worshiping the living God, Yahweh. Remember, it's not about who you worship now, it's how you worship the true God. The little statues, figurines, completely under no circumstances are to be used. Now open your Bible. Let's see how quick our group is at learning to Exodus chapter 32. Moses has gone up on the mountain is the historical setting. Moses has gone up. God has come, right? We've had the thunder. We've had the smoke. We've had the lightning. We've had the rumblings. The people are afraid. God has spoken the Ten Commandments. Now Moses has gone up onto the mountain to receive them in written form and bring them back. And as we pick up the story, Exodus 32, verse 1. When the people saw that Moses was long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, come, make us gods who will go before us. It's almost like they were, you know, hard of hearing or had kind of spiritual wax in their ears. Wait a second. Less than 40 days ago, I mean, God spoke and you were terrified, and now you're coming to Aaron and saying, make gods for us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up from Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. In times of uncertainty, in times when we want to touch and feel God, when times when we fear the future and we want to take control of our world, the temptation is to build an idol of one kind or another. And so we pick up the story. Aaron answered them, take off the gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me. Maybe he thought round one is if it really costs something to make an idol, they'll back away because Aaron knows better. Well, that doesn't work. So all the people took off their earrings and they brought them to Aaron. And he took what they handed them and he made them into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioned it with a tool. Then they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. Now, is this mind-boggling? I mean, up on Mount Sinai, God is in the process of giving the commandments to Moses, and these people now have made a molten image. They have called it their God, and they've given this image credit for bringing them out of Egypt. And the historical background here, there was a bull god in Egypt, and it was very potent, it was very powerful, and so Aaron probably, now notice carefully, they're not worshiping the bull. Notice what the text says. It says here, then they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there'll be a festival to the Lord. Same word, Yahweh. They're going to worship Yahweh. They're going to worship the one true God. But they've decided, since they can't see him and they don't know where Moses is, we're going to use some visual aids or images to help us. So the next day, the people rose early and notice now they're going to sacrifice burnt offerings and they presented fellowship offerings. And afterward, they sat down to eat and drink and they got up to indulge in revelry. It's a very interesting word. All the worship they've known is what they've watched happen in Egypt or what they've heard about in Canaan. And what they did when they couldn't see, when they couldn't control, when they couldn't tame God, they made an image. And after they made the image, then they sacrificed animals, they shed blood, they offered it to this thing they could see, and they had this sense of we're in control again. And then the pagan revelry, that is just one of those words that talk about immorality, because every worship of idols always leads to immorality. Jot down, if you were, 1 Corinthians 10:20. The Apostle Paul, when he talks about idols and things offered to idols, he says literally there was real power and there were demonic spirits behind it. Put in your margin also Ephesians 5:5-6, where he talks about as we walk in fellowship and truth with Christ, he says, no immoral or greedy or impure person, and then the little phrase, which are idolaters, will inherit the kingdom of God in Christ. And so what we see happening here is people are following base worship, and it starts with this molten image, and God says, don't do it. That's the application for Israel. I remember about 20 years ago playing on a basketball team, and we played different Olympic teams all throughout South America. And we were one of those international teams, and at halftime we shared Christ, and tremendous. That's how God got my attention in terms of full-time ministry. And we went to La Paz, Bolivia, and there's a statue in La Paz called the Christ of the Andes. And I don't know how many, maybe 6 stories high. I mean, it's huge. Life size, I mean, just huge thing. And I would watch, and of course it's up about 12, 15,000 feet. And we went to visit. I mean, this is big tourist deal. And I watched the poorest of poor people. Some people walk for miles, and then the last mile or two on their hands and their knees, they would go to the Christ of the Andes. And certain portions of that statue were rubbed completely raw as people crawled, and they had blood on their knees and their elbows, and they would kiss the statue, believing that in some way kissing that statue, they made some deep connection with God, and their worship of God was built around that response. Do you understand why God says, I don't want this? I don't want this. No matter how sincere people are in the images or the statues, the pictures, he says, I don't want this. It reduces me. I came across something that was almost mind-boggling, but a little bit more modern. It says, today, idolatry is alive and well. In fact, Jesus can be yours by calling, gives a toll-free number. Callers can purchase a Jesus doll who bends at the waist and is machine washable. He looks friendly and is nearly 2 feet tall. He wears a white tunic under a red robe, which sets off a red heart emblazoned on the front of his tunic. His creator sees the doll as a special help to children because it's hard to hug air, speaking of the invisible God. But it also provides solace to the elderly and the infirmed and those under emotional duress. Jesus is only the first in a line of dolls called First Fruits. He can be yours for $29.95 and would make a fine companion for the soon-to-be-introduced God doll. And you just thought it was some natives down in the heart of the Amazon that were using idols and worshiping idols. Music is pretty big in this Maranatha tradition, is it not? I kind of get the idea from a lot of different backgrounds, and seems like if you get up here and speak, you can play the piano. It must be a gift. About by the fourth night, I'm going to get behind the piano. I mean, they had 4 guys do it, a guy out of the audience, a guy shares his testimony. I mean, it just must come with the place. And so probably everyone here would say they can appreciate deeply Handel's Messiah. Unbelievable piece of music. But what if someone had never ever heard Handel's Messiah? And what if we took, as talented as these musicians are at this conference, if I would say, you know, these people, you know, who've never heard Handel's Messiah, they have got to at least get a taste of it. And I got them up here behind all those 6 or 7 microphones, and then I pulled out a very special instrument. I mean, I pulled out a little kazoo. Okay? And then I would give them all a kazoo. And then there was people who've never heard the beauty of Handel's Messiah. And I would say, okay, ready, gang? A 1, 2, 3. What would be the problem with that? I don't know about you, I think I'd rather have them never hear Handel's Messiah through a kazoo than hear it that way. And see, that's what God is saying. You see, when you try and take something that is majestic and powerful and invisible and you reduce it down to something tangible, seeable, foldable, and controllable, you reduce God for who he is, and that's what's behind the second commandment. It reduces him. It makes him smaller. And so any more, you can no more catch the glory and the beauty of Handel's Messiah on gazoos than you can trying to get your arms around who God really is by making an image of this or a picture of that. In the Santa Cruz area, one of the great things we always did, the tallest trees in the world are there. And anybody here, by the way, you can do this. Anybody ever seen the Redwoods? Anybody been out to the Redwoods? Boy, more people than I thought. I still remember my first time. Some of them are 280, 300 plus feet. Others are so big around and there has been burned where the inside of the tree has been burned, where you can get my whole family and five or six friends and you're inside the tree. And I'll never forget the first time looking, I mean, straight up, the majesty of these trees. You talk about creature demonstrating the invisible attributes of God. I mean, it is just, it's breathtaking. And every time anyone from out of town came, there was one place we had to go. We went to the Redwoods, and there was a long walk where you could see all these different Redwoods. And can you imagine someone who's never seen the Redwoods, and especially those who've seen them, if I said, okay, here's a box of toothpicks, and here's some Elmer's glue. I want you to put together a model of the Redwoods for those people that have never seen them. What's the problem? The problem is you could describe it with words and you could describe it with the images in people's minds that would help them so much more get a faint grasp of the Redwoods than you ever could with toothpicks and putting them together. That little model would so reduce the majesty and the power and the holiness in that sense of those Redwoods that it would be a terrible thing to try and make a model. And this is what's behind the second commandment. Summary then. God demands that we worship him in spirit. No material object, no matter how sincere, no icon, no statue, does God justice. It simply can't represent him for who he is, his transcendence and his glory.
Chip will be right back. But if you're just joining us, you're listening to Living on the Edge with Chip Ingram. Chip's message, No Worship But True Worship, is from his series, God's Boundaries for Abundant Living. As Chip explained today, rather than a harsh list of prohibitions, the commandments are actually life-giving instructions from a heavenly Father who loves his children. God's Boundaries for Abundant Living provides a high view of God that'll give you a new appreciation of your relationship with him, creating a solid foundation for every aspect of your life. If that's something you'd like to learn more about, we want to help. For a limited time, the CDs for God's Boundaries are discounted and the MP3s are absolutely free. You'll find God's Boundaries resources on our website, livingontheedge.org. Or if you'd prefer to talk with one of our customer care representatives, give us a call at 1-888-333-6003. Well, Chip, as I listened to today's message, I realized how easy it is to take the blessings of God and start worshiping them rather than the God who gave them to us. How can we help people develop and maintain a thankful attitude toward God?
Dave, great question, because, you know, when you first hear this, we have this picture of, you know, maybe people bowing down before, you know, rocks or images and things, and we think, oh, we never struggle with that. But the fact of the matter is that we do, and maybe they're on our computer screens, or maybe that's that car someday we're going to have and we put on the refrigerator, or we even have a family picture, and the very gifts from God become something that we worship. And we right. say, all that matters is my family. And we reduce God, and we make him number two and those things number one. And so we did a series on the genius of generosity. Hmm. It's about holding things loosely. It's worshiping the Creator instead of what's created. And as you give, as you hold things loosely, there's this joy and this recognition that it really belongs to God and that we're stewards. And it helps us be free of worshiping God in a way that will ultimately bring destruction in our lives. And so the genius of generosity, that's a resource that I think can really help.
Well, the series Chip just mentioned is called The Genius of Generosity, and all of the Genius of Generosity resources are available now on our website, livingontheedge.org. That's the CDs, MP3s, the book, and the small group with study guide. The Genius of Generosity goes beyond the premise of being generous with our money to reveal a much broader concept of generosity. Living a life of generosity will bring joy and freedom like never before. Go to livingontheedge.org today for complete details on Chip series, The Genius of Generosity. Or if you prefer, just give us a call at 1-888-333-6003. Well, now here's Chip with a final application.
As we close today's program, I want you to kind of lean back and let the RPMs of the day and your soul slow down a little bit. And I just want to ask you an honest question, and not to produce guilt, not to push you in any direction, but just, you know, we heard something very, very heavy. God demands to be God and to be God alone in your life. And you are human and I'm human, and we will all gravitate and drift toward reducing him. You know, we want to put him in a box. We want to make him a part of our formula. And if you're not careful, I mean, I've done this. I mean, and I've pastored for about 30 years now, and I watch the rest of us do this, is what we try and do, you know, and it happens so subtly, is we say, God, how can you help me fulfill my will? You know, it's like, will you be my little junior helper so that I can have a wonderful family and a great job and that I'll be happy? And we forget that he's the infinite reference point, that he is holy. And we take wonderful, beautiful gifts from a loving God, like our mates or our jobs or gifts and abilities in music or athletics. And pretty soon we make that the God. And so let me ask you, what could have slipped into first place? What could you be worshiping? And if the immediate reaction is, oh, no, no, well, let me just ask you this. Where is your time and energy and thinking and money gravitating toward? Where does it go? Because that's where your God is. That's what holds you up. If you don't have time to talk with God, if you don't have time to read his word, if you don't have time to serve him, and if you're not doing it with a conscious recognition of loving people, then I would suggest that God in his grace had you listen to me at this moment to allow you to shift your focus back on him, make whatever adjustments, tell him you're sorry, and get your heart realigned with where it needs to be for your good and his glory.
Just before we close, we want you to know that as a staff, we ask the Lord to help this teaching strengthen your faith. We ask him to help you confidently take whatever your next faith step is, and we'd love to hear how it's going. Would you take a minute to send a note or give us a call? Either one is easy. Just send a quick note to chip@livingontheedge.org or give us a call at 1-888-333-6003. Well, I hope you'll make plans to join us again tomorrow when Chip continues his current series, God's Boundaries. Until then, this is Dave Drewy saying thanks for listening to this edition of Living on the Edge.